The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
You will have heard on the show and across the station generally a lot of coverage recently of the Middle East, a lot of coverage of what has been happening the last number of days in Syria. And we've been trying to take as broad a view as possible of it, both from journalists on the ground, from analysts and from people with experience in the region. And one of the latter is a man who is hugely famous for both his books, a lot of travel writing, and his comedy, particularly years ago, the Trigger Happy TV show, which was such a success and so groundbreaking at the time. But he was born in Lebanon and grew up, I think he was six, before he left Lebanon. He is Dom Jolly. Dom, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Although I didn't leave Lebanon when I was six. I was sent off to boarding school in England, but I used to go back every holidays, and my family, parts of my family still live in Beirut, and my son was there this summer, so I'm very much still part of Lebanon.
Do you regard yourself as Lebanese?
No, I'm not Lebanese at all. So it's a very complicated thing. We're a British family, but who've lived there for three generations. So, it was very odd. It's actually something that's always, I think, slightly influenced my comedy. In Lebanon, I was always this weird British kid, and when I came to school in England, I was always this weird kid that lived in Lebanon. So I'm a floater. But, you know, I kind of feel very much at home in the Levant. But, you know, I've been in England for so long now. But I go back there a lot. And I wrote a book, I walked the length of Lebanon about 5 years ago, from the Israeli border in the south to the Syrian border in the north. And, you know, it's very, very close to my heart, as is Syria, actually, a place I used to go to a lot. Ironically, growing up in Lebanon in the middle of a civil war, we used to go to Syria to get away from the war, you know, and go out on expeditions in the desert. And then, of course, everything flipped. And suddenly, over 1.5 million Syrian refugees came into Lebanon, you know, and that's a country with only 3 million people. So that was a massive change. So, yeah, I'm very used to the turmoil of the Middle East.
Before we get to the most recent turmoil, given your sort of unique lens on being able to both to sort of see Lebanon from a first-hand perspective and see Middle East from a first-hand perspective, but also to understand the view that there is, particularly in UK and in Irish media and broader dialogue, what is it that people get wrong about the perception of Lebanon and Syria? What's your view that you find jarring with the common take?
Well, on a very basic level, I mean, the reason I wrote my book, The Downhill Hiking Club, was because really, whenever people think of Lebanon, they think of war and car bombs and terrorism. And they possibly also think, because it's the Middle East, that it's desert and camels, you know, which you couldn't be further from the truth. Lebanon, the best way I describe it, where I lived and live, you know, our family house is in the hills above Beirut. You know, Beirut's an incredibly cosmopolitan city. We were an hour away from the Mediterranean, from the beach, an hour from the ski slopes of Lebanon. You can ski in Lebanon. And, you know, where I lived was a cross between the south of France and sort of parts of California, pine forests and beautiful weather. So it's a stunning, stunning place, Lebanon. And that's part of the issue, really, because Lebanon is so mountainous and wild. Over the last, you know, two, three centuries, whenever anyone, any minority got in trouble in any areas of the Ottoman Empire or the sort of flatter desert areas of the Middle East, they'd sort of retreat to Lebanon and build themselves a little fortress, if you like, in a hill in Lebanon. And that's what Lebanon ended up as, and still to an extent is. I think last I looked, there was something like 32 different religious subsects, all living in different parts of Lebanon, all with their own militias and their own traditions. And obviously, for ages, this was kept going incredibly delicately. Even the Lebanese constitution, when it became, you know, it was a French mandate. And then when it became a country, Lebanon, after the Second World War, the constitution was written so that everyone had a place. You know, the president is always a Christian Maronite. The prime minister is always a Sunni Muslim, etc. And everyone had a place. But unfortunately, the demographics have changed since then. And Muslims tend to have more children than Maronites. And so for ages, the Maronites refused to have another population census. And then, of course, everyone uses Lebanon as a kind of battleground, as a kind of game strategy board. So you've had, you know, living there, I was shot at by Syrians and invaded by Syrians. I had Israelis invade. I had the Americans came in, Russians. I mean, pretty much everyone. So it's such a complicated, beautiful country. That's what so when I wrote my book, it was sort of like a love letter to Lebanon, really.
So tell me then what the events of recent years and particularly recent days. What effect that is going to have both on Lebanon, in your view, in Lebanon, Syria and the wider Middle East?
What's really interesting about Lebanon is, you know, the trouble in Lebanon started in 1975. That's when the civil war started. And there was a very bad civil war, 75, 76. And then on and off since then, obviously, it's had a lot of trouble and a lot of conflict. But the remarkable thing is that the economy, it has a massive, there's a massive Lebanese diaspora. Lebanese do very well. You know, they're descendants of Phoenicians. A lot of Lebanese don't see themselves as Arabs. They're traders, they're Phoenicians. And so they're very good at business. And, you know, they've survived. The economy was always working very well. And you'd always be so surprised at how normal Lebanon was when you went there, even during conflict. The thing that really changed Lebanon was the explosion in the port, which was, I can't remember when actually now, but about 4 years ago, 3 years ago. And that weirdly was nothing to do with conflict. That was actually corruption and just people storing the wrong things. But that explosion was so enormous and so massive, and it created so many homeless people. And it, that sort of broke the Lebanese economy. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And so Lebanon's been in a terrible situation for several reasons. The influx of Syrian refugees after the Syrian civil war started in 2012, you know, a massive amount of people in a very small country coming in. The economy finally collapsing in 2020 to the extent where people couldn't get their savings out. There's a dual economy in Lebanon. If you've got dollars or foreign currency, you can live like a king. But if you only earn Lebanese pounds, then you can't get access to your own stuff. And then on top of that, you've got Hezbollah, who act as a kind of state within a state, being financed by Iran and backed by Iran, essentially to cause trouble. And they've literally sort of had a grip on the state and stopped any real elections or any progress in Lebanese politics. So Lebanon really was stagnant. For the last 4 years, it was in a real, real state. And so strangely, what's happened now is obviously, you know, what Israel is doing in Gaza is just appalling and overkill on a massive level. And their attacks on Hezbollah have also been massively But certainly their attacks on Beirut have certainly been a massive overreaction. However, for the Lebanese, there could be a silver lining to it because Hezbollah have been, you know, certainly immensely weakened. And there's a chance that hopefully the Lebanese can somehow reclaim their state from the grips of Hezbollah. But also alongside that, the idea that a lot of these Syrian refugees who the Lebanese have looked after and been very kind to, but, you know, as the economy collapses, there's been resentment towards them. And hopefully with this new uncertainty in Syria, a lot of Syrian refugees can make their way home, which would alleviate a lot of problems in Lebanon. Within Syria, it's much more complicated. Syria, I think, is going to break into three parts. There's a sort of Kurdish eastern part of Syria, which already existed as a sort of semi-autonomous state, and they want to expand that, although Turkey won't be excited by that. The ruling party, Assad, was an Alawite, which is a sort of offshoot of Shia. And they live, their territory is in north of Lebanon along the Mediterranean coast of Syria by towns called Latakia and Tartus. And they're lucky in the sense that the Russian base, the Russians had a massive naval base and still do in Syria called Tartus. And the Russians are not going to want to lose that naval base because it's strategically very important for them. So I have a feeling the Russians will encourage the Alawites to create a separate little state on the Mediterranean, and the Alawites will want to be safe from revenge from 50 years of terrible rule over Syria, and the Russians will use that to keep their base. And so the interesting thing in Syria is what happens in the middle, what happens in Damascus, what happens with this new group who used to be very radical but seem to be espousing some sort of slightly more calmer views, but what actually happens, I don't know. So like everything in the Middle East, it's all up in the air, but it's very interesting times.
Can you give me a bit of a further analysis of how up in the air? On Monday night, we had a columnist from the Irish Independent with us called Ian O'Doherty. And one of the things that Ian was saying was that in his view, it is obviously laudable that an authoritarian regime is deposed. However, the net end result may be significantly worse than had the authoritarian regime remained in place. What's your take on that?
Well, this unfortunately is one of the nightmares of Middle East politics, because Syria, for instance, is not a natural country. This is a country designed in post-imperial times. So basically, Syria was sort of drawn on a map with straight lines and rulers after this agreement called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. When the Ottoman Empire collapsed, the British and the French just decided to carve up the Middle East for themselves. And they literally just drew lines, not sort of taking into account who lived where or what religions were where. So Syria's always been an unnatural state with rival people within it. So it's not a sort of a unified state. So yes, what happens next? I don't know, because the irony of the Middle East has been you normally are either faced with a very unpleasant totalitarian hard man in charge, but at least they keep the country together and stable, such as they did in Iraq. You know, Saddam Hussein, a completely unpleasant man, but he kept Iraq stable. Or you get rid of the hideous dictator like Bashar Assad, but then you run the risk of factionalism and revenge and every side trying to get control. And that's what's happening in Syria now. It remains to be seen whether the people taking over can be do a sort of South African thing and try and bring everyone together and forget the past and try and live a new life, or whether it just descends into chaos as Iraq did. It's almost impossible to tell. The only thing I know from speaking to Syrians that I know and Lebanese is that Syria's been so they're so tired of the fight. You know, it's been going on since 2011, 2012. So many people have died. Over 500,000 Syrians have died. And there is just a sense of total fatigue. So hopefully that might be something that kind of drives everyone to try and create a more stable Syria.
Although I would have thought that the kind of innate factionalism that you describe doesn't lend itself to the sort of the South African style Truth and Reconciliation project. I mean, there was horrendous strife, but it was at least binary.
Yes, you're absolutely right there. And that's one of the extraordinary things about the Middle East. Not only do you have this incredibly strong, division between Islam, between, Sunnis and Shias, and then Alawites are sort of offshoots of that. But, you know, Syria also has Christians and it has Druze. So all these people have to be taken into effect. But also, just as in Lebanon, there is a sort of unbelievable memory, historical memory in that area. So people in Lebanon would be angry with a village next door to them for something that had happened 200 years ago. You know, somebody's great-great-grandfather had been murdered on the road into the village, and that would be remembered. So all that kind of stuff is so indefinable. It's very difficult to know what can happen.
Can I ask you two further things, Dom? One, you made reference to Sykes-Picot and the British drawing lines on the map, and I think probably from an Irish perspective, we are a bit more live and sensitive to that thing.
The British, I would imagine you are, yeah.
The British side of you and the British side of the family, how do you square that? How do you view that?
I view it as well-intentioned to an extent. I mean, again, it's very difficult to look at those historical realities and talk about them as though, you know, we're in the present day. It was a time and a place when the Ottoman Empire was disintegrating and we'd won the war, and basically people were trying to work out what to do next. It was, I think what it really comes down to is the arrogance of it. It was that feeling of just knowing best. And, you know, supposedly you just rocked up somewhere, you had a look and you thought, right, that bit will go there and that bit will go there. And it's a shame, because actually there's a long history of English and British Orientalism and Arabists, people that really understood the country and understood the region. And if they'd really, for instance, Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence being a great example of someone who, unfortunately for the Brits, we said he went native and therefore he was sort of despised. But actually, he was exactly the person that would have understood, if you were drawing lines and frontiers, you know, where those lines should have been drawn so that they were more organic countries. But, you know, as a lot of these things happened, decisions were made by, sort of engineers and people back in London.
Lastly, then, you described the cosmopolitan nature of Beirut. You described the beauty and multiculturalism of Lebanon, and your sort of commitment to it, despite the strife that it has been through. Given the economic collapse in recent years, and given what's now happening on the border with Syria and all the implications that may have, from your perspective, is the juice still worth the squeeze? Is it still worth the association with and the continued presence in Lebanon?
What, by me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, firstly, I have no choice. It's not my home because I'm not Lebanese, but it is my home. It's in my blood. You know, like my, we've been there for three generations, and it's just I feel weirdly at home when I land in Beirut. It's an alien place, but I totally feel at home there. I speak, you know, I'm not brilliant at Arabic, but I can get by in Arabic. I speak French. I have friends there. It's just in my blood. So it's not a choice of whether I can get rid of it or not. But also I think, like the Lebanese, I'm an eternal optimist, actually, weirdly, for someone who's an ex-Goth and got kicked out of the Goth community for being too optimistic. I sort of am optimistic. I think actually this is a good moment for Lebanon. Weirdly, change often comes during chaos. You know, Naomi Klein wrote that book about the shock doctrine, which is the idea that great change in places comes at the most tumultuous moments. And actually, with the aftermath of the Israeli attack, the weakening of Hezbollah, the leaving, hopefully from the country of, you know, hopefully for them as well as for the Lebanese, of the Syrian refugees, I think there is a possibility that something might happen. But, you know, we've been up and down in Lebanon, certainly ever since I was born, and I've never known a stable Lebanon. And in a sense, that's the slight worry about it. It's almost intoxicating, the excitement of the place, the adrenaline, the uncertainty is what makes it such a special place. But I've always had the luxury, of course, of leaving, and a lot of people don't, and that's very different for them.
Dom, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for coming on the show. That is Dom Jolly.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.